Владимир Путин намерен решить самые насущные проблемы крымских
татар. Крымские татары собираются создавать национально-территориальную
автономию. Крутая крымско-татарского народа. Обсуждает последние события на Украине.
Станет татарский язык наравне с русским и украинским.
Прогнозом активно участвовали еще и крымские татары. Представители крымско-татарской
общественности. Реабилитация крымских татар сегодня поставлена на проходящем
обсуждение того, как крымские татары будут выстраивать свою жизнь в составе России.
Russia's largest ethnic minority just got larger. With Moscow's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean peninsula, some 250,000 Tatars have become reluctant Russian citizens. Most are not happy about this, and they're getting feisty, rejecting Russia's overtures and pushing for their own referendum on autonomy. And Russia's looming Crimean Tatar problem comes at a time when Moscow's relations with its existing 5-million-strong Tatar minority, concentrated mostly in the Volga region, are becoming increasingly tense. The Kremlin is celebrating its annexation of Crimea as a patriotic victory and evidence of Russia's revival. But will it come at the cost of yet another ethnic conflict? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in our studio is Rim Gilfanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. Welcome to the podcast, Rim. I've been wanting to have you on for a while.
Hello.
And also joining us here in Prague is Merkat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome back, Merkat. It's always good to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm always happy to have you here. And Rim, but we're going to start with Rim. Rim, let's start with you. The Crimean Tatar leader, Mustafa Jamilov, gave a combative speech at the UN Security Council condemning Russia. And as I understand, he's been barred from returning to his homeland. Fears are mounting among Crimean Tatars who have traditionally supported the Ukrainian authorities in Kyiv and who boycotted last month's independence referendum about potential reprisals from ethnic Russians. And last weekend, the Crimean Tatar Assembly voted to hold a referendum on national autonomy. Meanwhile, Russia's state-controlled media has dialed up its attacks on Tatars with dark suggestions of ties to Islamic extremists. Are we heading to some kind of ethnic conflict here?
Well, if even the things in Crimea have been going more or less in peaceful way so far, one thing is quite sure, the Moscow got really big headache with Crimean Tatars. You know, historically, this ethnic group was staunchly anti-Moscow, let's say. I'm not saying anti-Russian. But
anti-Kremlin.
Anti-Kremlin anyway, during the Tsarist time and after the short period of national autonomy in 20s, it really suffered a lot under Stalin's regime. You know that the whole nation was deported to Central Asia and Siberia, and the half of the nation died actually on the way to Surgun, as they call the deportation. And after Perestroika, and especially as Crimea went to independent Ukraine, the Crimean Tatars they're showing openly they don't want to join Russia, no way, anyway. So, because they see the Russian state as their main enemy in the way of ethnic national development. And this community, which has been really the most proactive, even during the 90s and when Crimea was with Ukraine, so this community now is in Russia. And there is an option, possibility that Crimea would become another North Caucasus.
Yeah, no, that's what I want to get at the risk of hyperbole, but I'm not quite sure it is hyperbole. Now, you said things have been peaceful so far in Crimea, but that's not quite. I mean, there have been incidents, right? I mean, there's been some incidents of attacks on Tatars.
I just meant that there were no armed conflicts so far. Of course, I mean, there were some incidents. One Tatar was actually killed.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and he was discovered with signs of torture on his body.
It was taken like criminal case, but nevertheless, it happened. And I personally saw it like a sign of intimidation, I mean, warning to Tatars just to keep quiet. And another sign why Moscow actually and Putin himself sees Tatar problem really seriously. And if, as the Crimea was annexed to Russia, there was the biggest problem. Wasn't the Ukrainian troops over there? By the way,
it was the Tatars?
Moscow just solved that problem very easily, and it was well prepared. But with Tatars, it's getting a big problem. That's why actually there is another aspect of the problem. Putin immediately introduced Kazan Tatar.
This is something I want to talk about. Yeah,
to pursue Crimean Tatars to behave peacefully, to accept Russian rule. It doesn't work out so far, but I expect that Kazan will be used heavily in getting Crimean Tatars under the Russian authority.
Going forward, what do you think is, I mean, none of us are soothsayers here, but going forward, what do you see happening? Do you see the Crimean Tatars, albeit that they're going to be very unhappy, do you see them kind of swallowing this, or do you see them fighting this?
They are clearly unhappy, but at the same time, the life is going on, and they are still in peninsula. It's their homeland, and they have to stay there. Even if, some people already moved out of Crimea, but the majority will stay there anyway. So because they don't have any other way, I mean, homeland.
They have no place else to go. Yeah.
So taking into consideration that you can expect that Crimean Tatars or part of them will tend to cooperate somehow with new authorities. But so far, Majlis, this is the most organized organization, self-proclaimed ethnic parliament, they insist that Crimean Tatars, if even under any other than Ukrainian rule, they have to have their own autonomy. And they've risen the question, and we expect in few days, in mid-April, the Kurultai, this is the highest body, gathering, Congress of Crimean Tatar people, will be governed again in Bakhchisarai, in Simferopol, and they want to organize even a referendum on the status of the people.
And this came up, they voted on this last Saturday in the larger assembly to hold a referendum on a national autonomy. Merkat, I know you're a native of Kazakhstan, a U.S. citizen who's a native of Kazakhstan, but I also know you have Tatar roots and that you follow these issues very, very closely. What are your thoughts on the emerging situation with the Crimean Tatars now? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think that the idea... Well, Putin is very skillful here, as usual, very smart in terms of of how smart a former KGB officer can be. You can see that this Rustam Temirgaliyev, a Kazan Tatar who was born in Siberia and grew up in Ulan-Ude, he was placed there and became second person after Aksyonov. They always want to show Tatars their presence. It's just for internal PR.
This was the Soviet style, too. Yes, they would always have the head of the party would always be of the nominal titular ethnic group, and the deputy who's really in charge would be
Temirgaliyev has nothing to do with Crimea. He is an ethnic Tatar. He's a Kazan Tatar who was born in Siberia. But all this stuff is played very well. Again, we know that two individuals representing Majlis already sent by Majlis as being acting representatives of the community in the new pro-Russian government or Russian government now in Crimea. This is also a smart move, and I understand Majlis too, because they have to live there and they have to at least find some ways to deal with these new circumstances. I think the standoff will be there all the time. We have to take into consideration that the Crimean Khanate was the last part of the former Golden Horde, which became separate when the Golden Horde collapsed and there were different Khanates led by grandsons, sons of Chinggis Khan and their children. And that Khanate was the strongest. Kazan Khanate fell, Astrakhan Khanate fell in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. In the end of 16th century, Siberian Khanate also fell down. And the Russians annexed Siberian Khanate, and Khan Kuchum had to get protection from Crimea and from Nogai Horde, which was very strong. I'm talking about all right. this
but
historic
the, but the Crimea, it lasted into the time of Catherine the Great, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. In different ways, yes. The thing is that, and very interesting how the history repeats itself here, we have to remember that in 1774, the Kuchuk-Kaynarja Treaty, signed by Russia and Turkey, actually this Kuchuk-Kaynarja today is in the territory of Bulgaria, mm-hmm. According to that treaty, Russia received the right to protect the rights of Christians in Turkish right. Empire. Plus, Crimea was announced independent de jure, mm-hmm. But under the protection of Turkey. And the deal was, if Crimea becomes a subject of any country, Turkey has a right to take it back.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's interesting how today we're talking about the defending rights of Russian speakers on Crimea and elsewhere in Ukraine. Right. The same thing happening. In 1783, Catherine the Great annexed Crimea by force.
And the reason was to protect the rights of Orthodox Christians. Yes,
absolutely.
Which is the,
absolutely.
The functional equivalent of protecting the rights of Russian speakers.
Yeah, yeah. And Orthodox Christians, we're mainly talking about Bulgarians and mainly of Pontian Greeks who lived in Crimea at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think you suggested that Putin's actually been very skillful at his attempts at dividing the Crimean Tatar community? I'd like to hear from both of you. How successful do you think that, Grim, you alluded to it a bit. How successful do you think that's going to be?
As I said, it's going to be very hard. I think Putin didn't create anything new. It's a usual thing. The same tactics was everywhere, and the same tactics is being used now by dictatorships in Central Asia when the opposition groups are divided, you know, the same game. It's an old Russian imperial and Soviet style, KGB style, whatever. But with Crimean Tatars, it's going to last longer, mm-hmm. and we'll have more problems. Sorry if I interrupted.
Rim, go.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a... As I see the situation, Putin actually thinks the Tatars in Russia, they really live in good conditions. He thinks that, especially after all this aspiration for independence was sort of, you know, cleared in Tatarstan, mm-hmm. the more or less stable regime with new president established over there. And last year they organized rather good these university games, and Tatarstan now is considered one of the most developed regions in Russian Federation with good investment climate. So he thinks that Tatars are enjoying good freedom in Russian Federation, and he thinks that he can offer the same for Crimean Tatars. But again, we are coming to this... to the point that we already said, Crimean Tatars are different. They have really bad experience with Russian government mm-hmm. of any times. So, and we can get to the point that they will try to get to do utmost to their rights protected somehow. And that's why they are raising this question about the autonomy, because they think this is the one of the most important conditions of preserving the ethnic identity.
But what does this autonomy mean in practice, really? I mean, the Russian media has been presenting it as quote-unquote cultural autonomy, but if I understand what's coming out of the Crimean Tatar assemblies, it's more national autonomy, and then what does that mean? Are we talking about territory? What are we talking about?
Well, here? Crimean Tatars talk about the territorial autonomy, otherwise it has no reason.
I mean, it has no meaning.
Yeah, this national or cultural autonomy, it was actual for Habsburg right. times, you know, here in Central Europe. But in terms of Russia, it will be just continuing of a Russification. And, of course, it's really hard to imagine it, what kind of form it will be mm-hmm. implemented. For example, before the war, the Crimean Tatar autonomy existed yes. in the mm-hmm. peninsula. Of course... many Russians, other ethnic groups lived there. They had no problem. But the autonomy was basically Crimean Tatar, and the Crimean Tatar language was an official state language over there, among with Russian language. So, well, world's experience can provide us with some any other options, why not? But I'm not sure if Moscow opened to these options.
Right. Now, one of the things I wanted to... go ahead, Mirko.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing here about Crimean Tatars. We know that many ethnic groups during the Soviet time were deported to Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, other Central Asian places, and Siberia. But we have to remember there were several ethnic groups who had never been rehabilitated. The Meskhetian Turks, their Crimean Tatars... They're ethnic Germans. Mm-hmm. Ethnic Germans never received their autonomy in Volga area with the capital Engels back. Mm-hmm. And I know personally, because I grew up in Kazakhstan where ethnic Germans were there, there was a special rule that ethnic Germans cannot be appointed as the first leaders of any group or any organization or any state board or anything. They they can be only deputies. Mm-hmm. Crimean Tatars never got their... Chechens and Ingush, they got back there. Chechen and Ingushetia, Autonomous Republic, all those other ethnic groups were, if there were no apologies, but at least they were rehabilitated officially during Khrushchev period.
Well, they were permitted to
go back. Go back.
But not Tatars.
But Crimean Tatars got this opportunity in late 80s only.
Right, only in perestroika. Why was that?
Well, there are many issues here. Because Crimea, as a person who visited Crimea several times, I can tell you, when I first came there in 1991, I immediately understood why the world empires were fighting for this place.
It's beautiful.
It's such a beautiful and amazing place.
I've been there once. It's quite stunning.
Geopolitically, it's very important. It's important. Who controls Crimea?
Controls the Black Sea.
Controls Black Sea's major part on the north. And that's why nobody wanted Crimean Tatars back there. The idea was to Russify the territory completely.
The Russians consider Crimea actually like a jewel in the crown. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, Potemkin actually said that to Catherine the Second, as he wanted her to conquer Crimean Khanat finally. So this is the most beautiful jewel in your crown. So the history continues here, and Russia considers Crimea as a poorly Russian territory, as a big achievement of the foreign policy.
Now, one of the things I wanted to do here is step back a bit, because I mean I had to do a little bit of homework preparing for this podcast, because about the different groups of Tatars, from the Crimean Tatars to the Kazan and the Volga Tatars and so on and so forth. I'm not entirely ignorant of it, since I did live in Kazan for 6 months and actually learned the Russian language at Kazan State University. But Rim and Mirka, if you could both kind of walk us through this. I mean, why don't you start, Rim? Kind of like, how are the Crimean Tatars different from the Kazan Tatars and other groups of Tatars that we find in the Russian Federation and beyond the borders of the Russian Federation?
We have common history. This is the main thing, what unites us, Kazan and Crimean Tatars. But given the geopolitics, the rise of the Russian state, these two groups are even there are several Tatar groups. I mean, Siberian,
the languages are even different.
Yeah, I mean, they got divided, actually. Mm-hmm. And the development went on different ways. So Crimean Tatars, given their history and the closeness to the Ottoman Empire, they are very, and culturally, in terms of language, habits, mentality even, they are very close to Turkey. Mm. And now, especially as after the perestroika, as the country opened, they established very good cultural relations with Turkey, and Turkey always helps Crimean Tatars in this. But Kazan Tatars, we remain deeply in the empire. So again, the language developing in a different way. So in common historical heritage unites us. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, unfortunately, we are different now.
How are the relations between the different groups of Tatars?
There were some attempts, to make common projects, like creating common alphabet, for example, based in Latin. And the Crimean Tatars have the Latin alphabet. But Kazan Tatars, who also joined this common project, they were banned by Russian Duma as Putin came to power. And the official explanation was like the Latin alphabet destroys the common cultural space, meaning, again, this chauvinistic, let's put it that way, circles in Russia, they thought that introducing Latin alphabet would endanger Russian cultural space. So, even in terms of mentality, we are now different. That's why when Kazan Tatars, they've been under Russian Empire several centuries, and they still survived. Nevertheless, they tend to be more collaborative.
Right. Now, the Kazan Tatars are a much larger group, right? You have over 5 million of them, and the Crimean Tatars are 250,000 or so, give or take, right? And
well, we're talking about Tatarstan. The Kazan Tatars are living everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And this is the number of 5 million. It's talking about maybe probably about Tatarstan only. Mm-hmm. But
surrounding regions, the Volga region.
Yeah, but if you look at Moscow, for instance, Tatars are the third ethnic group there, and you can find anyone. Talking about Tatars, even in Volga area, even Russians have a joke with saying that scratch your Russian face and Tatar comes up. Right. So comes out. So talking about history, what is common today? To answer this question it's easy. Just imagine a huge empire. A country, Golden Horde, which numerous subjects, and in the 14th, 15th century, it started collapsing due to different reasons. One of the major reasons was that Huns were dividing their countries to their sons. Mm-hmm. Their sons were dividing to this regions to their grandsons, and all this nomadic culture, which was Mongol aristocracy, which were not local Turks. Mm-hmm. Has their own rules, and Turkic tribes who were dominating the area, and even though they were ruled by Mongol aristocracy for centuries, they never accepted Mongol language, and they were culturally higher. All these factors brought us to the situation historically when they appeared a huge Khanates or countries which were smaller than the Golden Horde, but they were very powerful for many centuries, for several centuries after the collapse of the Golden Horde. Astrakhan Khanate, Nogai Horde, what we call today Crimean Khanate. Crimean Khanate was not only Crimea, to tell you. It went further. It was covering even some parts of today's what we call today's
Eastern Ukraine.
Ukraine,
which wants to Russia now?
All other things. You know, that's why they shared one language. In today's term, it was a state language, Tatar Turkic language. But after the collapse of the Golden Horde, all these people was separated, and then Russian Empire was taking the territories one by one. And, of course, historically, the major part of those Khanates were swallowed by Russian Empire. Uh-huh. And the Crimean Khanate, the part of it which is a real Crimea, was the last one.
Was the last one holding out.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
this explains why the national identity is much more strongly formed among the Crimean Tatars. Yeah. Now, Rin, there's something you alluded to about how Moscow is using the Kazan Tatars to try to appeal to the Crimean Tatars to inform them of the wonders of being citizens of the Russian Federation. But at the same time, the Kremlin is also making moves in Tatarstan, and I know from your service's own reporting on this that they've been making moves in Tatarstan to suppress the Tatar language, to decrease the teaching of the Tatar language in schools in Tatarstan. Aren't these two things contradictory? Or on one hand, they're trying to use the Kazan Tatars to convince the Crimean Tatars how great it is in Russia, but with the other hand, they're suppressing the language and decreasing the ability for Tatars to learn their own language.
Yes, Kazan Tatars have huge problems with ethnic education, with culture, with the language, and which is slowly disappearing from the official public life. It's going back again to the kitchen as it was in Soviet times. But you know, all these things, they are not done officially, openly. For international community, Russia says we are a federation. We have equality of any other ethnic groups. We have a right to get an education in native language guaranteed by constitution. But the problem is it's not being implemented.
And your average man in the street in Kazan knows that's not being implemented, I would assume.
Yes, and they use different instruments to suppress the Tatar ethnicity, Tatar language, Tatar culture. For example, they widely use marginal Russian groups, mm-hmm. Or Russian nationality groups. So they voice their opposition to for studying Tatar language, for example. They don't want to study Tatar mm-hmm. language, though it's being declared as a state language along with Russian language in Tatarstan. So Putin does it, as Mirkhad said, he's very skillful in this, you know, intrigues, and these Byzantine and later Soviet kind of intrigues against ethnic minorities. And their main goal is, as I think, to create a homogeneous, you know, new nation, as they say, Rossiyani, politическая нация, political nation, with one language, preferably, and one religion, and with one mentality, which is being now, for these days, are being built by Russian television.
Right. Now, you indicated earlier that there's going to be a portion of the Crimean Tatars that, like a portion of the Kazan Tatars, who have kind of are collaborating with the authorities, for lack of a better phrase. Also, in your earlier comments, you said you speculated as to whether Russia's going to inherit some kind of North Caucasus type situation in Crimea. Taking these two things together, you know, is it possible that the part of the Crimean Tatars that are not co-opted, that are not co-opted by Russia, do you think they could become radicalized, and how radicalized? Because I know there's a lot in the Russian media alleging all of this Islamic extremism among Tatars. You barely can't pick up a Russian newspaper on any given day and not read something about it. But this seems to be, much of this is obviously nothing but propaganda. But is there any truth to this? And can part of the Tatar community become radicalized as a result of this?
They can, and there's a potential of being radicalized. And many people, since the conflict started among Tatars, many people among Tatars wanted to choose this way, armed resistance.
Yeah, that was my next question. Yeah. Do you see Tatars taking up arms?
But Majlis so far prevented them and calling for calm. But, of course, Russia, in this case, Russia relies heavily on the use of force. I think the Crimea will be a new fortress now. Mm. Not only for enemies from outside, but from enemies internal from enemies as well. So it's not only Black Sea Fleet, but a lot of security forces will be located over there. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, Russia will try to keep the resistance in more or less
contained. But you don't rule out the possibility that...
I don't rule out, because the Crimean Tatar communities, they are really... they know what they can expect from Russian state, and actually, and the history proves mm-hmm. that they are right.
America,
I think I completely agree with Rim, but we have to take into account how organized they are. You cannot compare them with Dagestan or even with Chechnya, where they're even among the fighters for freedom or separatists, they are different groups. They are Wahhabis. Some of them are for the Ichkeria, or some of them are...
You don't see that among the Tatars.
No,
it's
I think Tatars are more organized. What they went through, and they have never been rehabilitated, what helped them to survive and to preserve their culture and language was their leaders. And they follow the leaders. You remember...
So the Majlis has a lot of authority.
Oh, yes.
People
will
listen to what
it
says.
And the latest contract actually get more people around Majlis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing is, Putin knows that. That's why he asked Gemilev to come to him. And he didn't meet him himself. He used former president of Tatarstan, Mitymir Shamiyev.
But they spoke on the phone, though.
Yeah, they spoke on the phone. But I'm sure, as a KGB person, he probably first learned what his position is, and then he talked to him by phone because he was in Sochi. But the other thing is here, what I want to say, I don't think Crimean Tatars will start doing something unless Majlis says go ahead. That's my opinion. They are more organized and they're more structured. They're more. And also, just we have to remember that they've been living in a country for the last 23 years called Ukraine, where they had freedoms. Freedoms were much, much more tangible than in neighboring Russia.
Well, I'm interested to see what happens when the Russian population of Crimea comes to understand that the freedoms it used to have are out the window.
They never ever demanded separation from Ukraine.
No.
They were
very loyal to Kyiv.
And this is very big difference.
Yeah.
And it's not because of Kyiv was so good towards Tatars. Actually, Kyiv has also their own mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kyiv could do something with Tatars, but never did.
But they were realistic.
But nevertheless, Tatars understand that it's much more easier to protect yourself in Ukrainian state, within Ukrainian
state. Imperfect democratic state.
Yeah.
Then
in Russian
state.
Empire. And there's one paradox here. You know, of course, Moscow will try to corrupt as many Tatars as possible, giving financial help or different state positions. But for that, Moscow needs to establish this territorial autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, why Kazan Tatars are so eager to cooperate, to follow Moscow's line? Because they have quasi-statehood.
Yeah.
And many Tatars engaged in this quasi-statehood, which is a part of the Russian state. They are getting their money from that state. They are established, they are incorporated in this state structures. So, in a sense, they defend themselves, defending Russia. And if Moscow wants to do the same with Crimean Tatars,
maybe this
it
is
has
the way to
accept this territorial autonomy.
But we're seeing no signs that they want to go in that direction. In fact, we're seeing signs
so far,
in
no,
the
yeah.
opposite
that's
direction.
Why, that's why they try different ways to persuade. But I think that any other ways will be soon closed. Mm-hmm. And
all right, well, Mirka, you mentioned Mustafa Jamilov, and that's a great segue to the second section of our podcast. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and narrow the aperture to focus on the longtime leader of the Crimean Tatars, Mustafa Jamilov, who has been very much in the news lately. I would like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in our studio in Prague is Rim Gilfanov, director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service, and Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFRL's Central Newsroom. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
We find it outrageous that Russia thinks in 19th century terms. They think if they conquered this territory once, then it must be Russian. This is a very unhealthy approach and it could have deplorable consequences. This position has no respect for our people's right to self-determination. The idea that Russia made up about the so-called Crimean people having a right to self-determination is absurd. There is no such thing as the Crimean people. There is an indigenous population, and there are migrants who came from inner regions of Russia.
He was just 6 months old when his family was deported from Crimea by Soviet forces in 1944. He grew up in exile in Uzbekistan. He was arrested 6 times and served time in Soviet labor camps, and he staged the longest hunger strike, 303 days, in the history of human rights movements in the Soviet Union. And now, at the age of 70, Mustafa Jamilov finds himself again on the barricades. Rim, tell us a bit more about Jamilov. What makes this man tick, and what can we expect from him going forward?
Mustafa actually is a legendary person. We talked already about the difference between Kazan and Crimean Tatars. By the way, during the Soviet times, I don't remember any Kazan Tatar dissident of that scale as Mustafa Jamilov, and there were a lot of them among Crimean Tatars because they were put in this position. They wanted to go back home, and they were banned going to Crimea. So And among all those Crimean Tatar dissidents, Mustafa Jemilev was the famous, and he automatically became a leader of the nation. And for decades, he was heading the Mejlis, Crimean Tatar Mejlis. Actually, he organized it.
Yeah. The first one. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a founder of the Mejlis, and he resigned only last year, giving the another leader, Rifat Chubarov, was elected as a chairman. And you know, it's if you see, I mean, in person, Mustafa Jemilev, he's really small, tiny person, actually.
I was actually looking at photos of him.
Yeah, and he really, and you start thinking, how is it possible that this guy actually went through Soviet prisons, Gulag, several hunger strikes,
303
fighting for the Crimean Tatars everywhere on international stage. He's very active. He's traveling a lot. He knows famous politicians on world stage, and he's such a small person, but he's personal
physically only.
Physically, yeah, physically. I mean, but he's a person of these firm principles. He believes that his nation deserves justice, and he does everything to reach that goal. The Crimean Tatars have the right for justice, and they have the right for self-determination to develop their language, ethnic identity, culture. And I think if even he resigned, he will continue his fighting.
And do you think, I mean, it's maybe a rhetorical question or an obvious question, but I mean, he's not been allowed back into Crimea.
No.
They don't want somebody of such moral... Does he have such moral authority among not just Crimean Tatars, but Tatars in general, that he could be dangerous for them?
He was in the States. He participated in the Security Council session until today. He was in the States, and today he returned to Istanbul, and he was going to participate in Kurultai's session, by the way, but so far we don't have any information. I think that he will not be allowed to go.
Mirka, you're familiar with Soviet era dissidents, since you were one. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I just want to add here, Russian authorities currently don't want him to be in Crimea because the negotiations, you know, some shadowy negotiations with Mejlis are going on. And they know Jemilev very well. Mustafa is a strong guy. He can see that you're trying to cheat him or do something. He's going to say to your eyes, straight between your eyes. And they know how strong the guy is, not only himself, but how known he's not only in the former Soviet Union, but all around the world. The guy went through hell, but never betrayed his stance. That's why he's a dangerous guy for now. They probably allow him to come back when all these deals are made. That's my thinking. At this point now, when Mejlis already kind of slowly is conceding and sending its representative to the new government in Crimea, they don't want they don't want Jemilev there.
So this is somebody you would have put in the first rank of Soviet dissidents. Yeah?
Oh yes, yeah. I think we can put him on the same level as Sakharov. Sakharov was more known only because he is an academician who created the nuclear bomb. But Jemilev was just a Crimean Tatar boy from Uzbekistan who openly said, "Hey, my people need justice." Everybody else was allowed to go home. Why don't we deserve this? And for that, he went through real hell there. Mm-hmm. We know that Sakharov at least once attended his trial,
mm-hmm.
and we know that there's some thoughts of Sakharov put on paper about this person. Really, this person is great. If you talk to him, yes, he is a thin person. You look at his eyes, and eyes tell you everything.
Well, let's actually listen to his voice again. We have a couple of cuts here from a recent interview Mustafa Jemilev gave to Voice of America, and we played one at the outset of this segment. Let's listen to another one now.
It is obvious that this occupation will continue for many years, but the Crimean Tatars will have to continue to exist and solve their problems somehow. And perhaps it would be wise to have a representative in the government. On the other hand, That would be collaborationism. We would be cooperating with illegal authorities, with a government run by bandits. And that is repulsive. And this is where our opinions split.
There you go. He's talking about what we were just talking about early on, that some people are going to find it necessary to collaborate with the Russian authorities, something he finds completely unacceptable. What happens if a deal is cut with the Mejlis and Mustafa Jamila says no? Who do the Crimean Tatars listen to?
In this case, probably we'll have a division inside the Mejlis. And most likely, Mustafa admits it himself that the life will go on and we will have to deal with new authorities. And Mejlis did very cleverly so far. He delegated two persons to deal with new government just in questions, in cases which are covering directly Crimean Tatar issues like social life, again cultural or any ethnic issues. But I think that Mustafa Jamilov will be the last person who, if accepts new government, I think he will not accept.
I don't think he will either.
Yeah.
But how powerful will his voice be if you do have a lot of collaborating?
He will find a lot of supporters among young generation because there are many young people in Crimea among Tatars who follows his views.
We're talking about 250,000 people here. Mm-hmm. For this 250,000 people, which is 12% of the Crimean Peninsula, population of the Crimean Peninsula, Jamilov is not just a legend, he's an icon. Mm-hmm. That's why he's banned from going to Crimea right now, while the Mejlis is trying to be bought. Mm-hmm. To any extent, maybe it's right to send two people because really people have to live there at least to have some representatives there to protect their rights within the government. The situation is very complicated. On the other hand, there are some Tatars, Crimean Tatars, who say, where is Ukrainian government? We are Ukrainian citizens. Mm-hmm. They are not protecting us. Where is Ukrainian army?
Well, we know where the Ukrainian army
is. Yeah. So that's what they're asking. If Ukrainian army, or Ukrainian state, which is our country, they're still citizens of Ukraine, is not doing anything, so we have to survive somehow and go. Mm-hmm. And the situation is very tricky, and Putin is using it on his... This week, he even recommended the government in Moscow to include Crimean Tatars into the decree of 1991 about the deported nations.
Right.
Now, the Crimean Tatars issue...
At what cost, but
at what cost, but the thing is, again, one of the examples, I just remember Nazi Germany today. When it was defeated, Germany said, sorry, and is still paying reparations to countries, to nations, to Jews, not only to those who were in concentration camps and stuff.
To this day, yeah.
Yeah, but if a Russian Empire said, or a Soviet Empire, or former Soviet leadership said, sorry, go home in 53, or if it's 56 when Chechens and Ingush people were allowed to go back, maybe the situation would be different.
Right.
But I don't know.
They didn't, and it isn't. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I know is the situation is very complicated, and Crimean Tatars are hostages right now there. Mm.
Can Jamilov be dangerous to the Kremlin even from exile?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He's
leader, actually, but he will be the main person who this young generation who doesn't want to go under Russian rule follow him. And he's a man of really firm principles.
And the young generation never lived under Russian rule, really. I mean, if you're born in 91, you're 22, 23 today, you 22-year-old Crimean Tatar, they don't know what it's like to live under Russian rule. They only lived under Ukrainian rule. And while they had their problems with it, they don't have the kind of problems they're going to have with Russia. So the combination of this 70-year-old legend and this young generation...
There is a thing like historical memory, and this memory is really strong. It's very strong among Crimean Tatars because deportation as I said, half of the nation died. It's not. I mean, the thing you can easily forget. And it was directly tied to the government, which still says that he's continues this Soviet Russian Empire and right. Soviet
same national anthem.
Not only deportation. I think every Crimean boy or girl knows from stories by their grandparents and great grandparents when Catherine the Great annexated Crimea in 18th century. Hundreds of thousands of Tatars fled to Turkey. Today in Turkey, you have a lot of people whose last name is Kırımlı of Crimea. And all of them are descendants of those people. And not only Crimeans, there are many others, but all this goes like a legend from generation to generation because the major issue from the birth of these people is to preserve their culture and language in the situation which is called living in empire, whatever empire it is.
Okay, well, before we wrap up, let's listen one more time to another quote from another cut from Mustafa Jamil. This is also from his recent interview with The Voice of America.
We have serious fears about what can happen there, so I've asked for a UN peacekeeping force. But since it is something that is decided by the UN Security Council, where Russia has the right to veto, it is unlikely to happen. Another option is a NATO force, as it was done in Kosovo. But the problem is that NATO comes only once a sea of blood has been shed.
Now here, I mean, he's talking about, like, you know, we're so scared about what might happen here that, you know, okay, these are two unlikely options, UN peacekeepers or NATO forces, but this is the only thing that might be able to protect us. Can the situation get dangerous for Crimea? It already seems to be getting dangerous for Crimeans in Tatars in Crimea. I mean, there have been reports that people have been told to evacuate their houses, of crosses being drawn on the homes of Crimean Tatars. You have the one case of the man who was killed with strong evidence of torture on his body. Rim, what do you think?
Given that we are dealing with Russia, I think, and not only Russia, I mean, things in former Yugoslavia happened in '90s or the 20th century, and who would say it after the World War II that it might happen again, but it happened. So in case of Russia, it might happen as well. I mean, we had two Chechen wars, for example, with a lot of blood, but I'm not that let's say optimistic or that NATO will be somehow engaged even in this case, because they will have to deal with nuclear power.
Right.
And in this case, they are always sort of, restrictive.
And it brings us back to what we were saying at the beginning. Outside help, I don't think, is coming. So, again, how radicalized can the Tatars become if things get bad?
It could have been implemented as Crimea was still part of Ukraine. But again, West saw somehow under-evaluated Moscow's policy. They didn't expect that Putin will act so quickly, and they actually lost Crimea.
Mirka, last word to you before we wrap up.
Well, I think, as I said, they are hostages. The situation is very complicated. I don't see any way out, tell you frankly. After what we heard what Jamilov said, we can see that he's in despair. He doesn't know what to do. The only thing for him is to fight not, of course, we all know this person. He's not calling for fight with arms in the hands, but he wants to fight diplomatically through other means. He's asking help from international community here. He's putting his doubts here, saying, well, Russia is a member of the UN Security Council and has a right to veto any decision on international peacekeepers there. And also he says NATO, but NATO comes only when many people are killed already. So what he says here, he's not directly but indirectly He's asking for help from the international community. Do something.
He's appealing to the conscience of the international community, and you have to wonder if that appeal is going to be to be heard.
Well,
there's certain this story is certainly going to develop in the weeks and months ahead, and RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service will continue to cover it excellently as it has up until now. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in our studio in Prague has been Rim Gilfanov, director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service, and Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst for RFRL's Central Newsroom. Thank you to both of you for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our superhuman producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.